Welcome back to Coast AM. So let me ask you a question. What do healthcare, climate change, terrorism, illegal immigration, substance abuse, and international geopolitical strife all have in common? According to my guest, who is an ER doc, Dr. John Moser, he says that these are all problems related to the rise of the modern human. He has a book out called The Super Civilization. It's about survival in the era of human versus human. And he talks about the major problems that are facing humanity today. He's going to come back and we're going to talk about his experience as an emergency room doctor. And he asked himself questions over and over and over again about how did we get here? How did we get into the place we're in? Where are we going? How do we change our course? And he's realized that there's a significant chance for a major die-off of humanity in this century. And it's due to control that our society is under without being aware of it. So we're going to come back and dive into this conversation with Dr. Moser when we come back. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Gar. And my guest is emergency room doctor, Dr. John Moser. And he says that basically we are facing in our society a chance of a major die-off of humanity this century. And this is due to the control our society is under and being unaware of that control mostly. And so for this eye-opening conversation about basically our whole entire world, welcome to the show, Dr. Moser.
Thank you, Ms. Gar. I'm glad to be on.
Oh, it's great to have you. And thank you so much for joining us. I know that you just finished your shift and that you wrapped a little bit early so that you could have a chance to talk with us on Coast. So I really appreciate this.
So it's my pleasure.
Tell me a little bit about your experience in the ER and how that has shaped your perspective about civilization.
Well, actually, it all started back in 2001 when right after 9/11, when we were putting together a bioterrorism conference. And that's what got me started on thinking how to deal with humanity's major problems, and the major problem at that time and still is terrorism. How do we deal with the terrorist? And we put together, my group in Fresno put together a conference for doctors, local doctors, in dealing with bioterrorists. And we invited the FBI, we invited a federal judge, we had several EMS individuals there. We were all scratching our heads because the conclusion we were coming to is basically the terrorists, if they really wanted to, they could find a way to make our lives difficult. So it was a monumentally difficult problem. And also what was really interesting at that time was how little the federal government really wanted to talk about it. Now, granted, it was right after 9/11 and
wow,
there was a lot of anxiety about it, but there was no clear desire to say, okay, terrorism, how do we deal with it? How do we effectively deal with the current situation? And this country went in the direction of basically turning the terrorist into the biggest problem of all. And granted, I think the terrorist is a despicable human being who's trying to undermine all of us and the great things that we've got in our world. So there's no doubt in my mind that that's the case. But we also, my goal in writing this book was to look inwards and look and see, okay, what can we all do to deal with the terrorist? And
that's a big question.
Yeah, right. And mm-hmm. And it's still a problem. You know, just the recent occurrences in the last couple of years have, if anything, made the terrorist more empowered than in the past. And not only that, what was concerning was the methods that we were using over the last 10 years to combat the terrorists, such as the Patriot Act, and the ways in which that we were trying to delve into metadata and looking at every little problem, when in fact my conclusions are different than most people's. My conclusions are that we are now a super civilization, and terrorism, if we don't do a few of the necessary things to deal with the terrorists and then deal with climate change, and the same pattern kept coming up over and over in my mind as to what the major problem was. And the major problem that I see today is we've yet to really acknowledge the existence of the super civilization and what I call the super civilization.
Okay, so explain what that is. What is the super civilization?
Yeah, the super civilization came on around the turn of the century as a combination of what I deem as three major factors and a minor factor. The first factor has to do with increased disparities in wealth throughout the world. If you look at, in my research into this, clearly looked at the data of the per capita GDP throughout the world, and I came to the conclusion that there are still individuals in the third world who are living at the same level, same standard of living as people did 100, 200, 300, 3,000 years ago. And at the same time, there are individuals, particularly in the United States, who have been able to live at such a high level of wealth. And what's also interesting is not only is there a disparity, but it's, and this is the key point, there's transparent disparity. So in other words, it's become more clear through the internet that individuals in Africa can see what's happening in the United States and see in Europe and see what we're living at and the standard of living that we're living at. And it's a natural
which increases the divide. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, but what's happening is most of the terrorist experts who, when I read their books, the conclusion was the same. It wasn't the Africans or the people living at their means of subsistence that were the problem. It was the next tier. It was the second world, not the third world, and not the first world that harbored a lot of the terrorism. And I think most terrorists, Louise Richardson, I read a few of her writings, have all come to the conclusion that it's the growth of these eras of the world where there's a young male population.
Rebellious.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Rebellious, and also they've been able to live beyond their means of subsistence, but not at the level that we have in the United States or Europe. So there's a lot of anger, jealousy, you can call it whatever you want to call it, that will predispose these individuals to wanting to destroy the United States, Europe, and the first world.
Just fuel. The first one. Fuel for targeting, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can call it a catalyst, you can call it gasoline, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect of the super civilization has to do with a declining resource base. So for the first time in our history, we're having to deal with declining resources. And what I focused on in the book wasn't necessarily, because you could take 100 resources, you could take water, you could take soil, topsoil, depletion, you know, you could take a variety of resources, but the key one, without a doubt, that I've hit on is energy. And even though the sun is producing virtually unlimited amounts of energy that could provide our civilization and the human and humans with an inordinate amount of energy, it's the actual capability of utilizing that energy. And that's something that's a real problem today, is that the types of energy that we have been so successful at utilizing, which is fossil fuels, in the beginning with the burning of wood, then coal, then oil, then now the big 21st century fossil fuel is natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it doesn't answer our questions, though, and what I'm getting into is that we have an exponentially growing population, as Paul Ehrlich would have said 30, 40 years ago, that continues to grow. And so what we have to do is not only to keep up with our standard of living, we have to have the capability of developing new resources, but we have to develop them to match our growing population. And that I see as a major problem.
The third.
Reliance, yes. Mm-hmm. It's the reliance on science, and that's the key thing. It's a reliance on science like we've never had before to sustain our existence as a species that is the problem. And that's where I get into the book in great philosophical detail on the theory of science, is that before this 21st century, we didn't have to rely on science to live as we live currently. Now it's imperative that the scientific community save the world. And that's the real conundrum that I see in the super civilization today.
Would you say that the idea that we're living as a society just making our bills every month type of mentality, where we just have enough resources to get us through this time and then this time, and then there's nothing in the reserves, there's nothing to that's put away for an emergency, that we're really living on the edge of our resources in terms of population growth and what you were talking about in terms of the disparity.
Yeah, I would say that those are two different aspects. One has to do with the ability to develop resources, and the other has to do with the ability to distribute those resources.
Okay.
And the development of the resources is a problem, as well as the distribution. And that gets into the first part of the super civilization, which is the disparity in wealth. The distribution aspect, which is it's clear amongst most economists today in the United States, and of course to people like Emanuel Saez, who's at Berkeley, who wrote about the disparities in wealth, and Thomas Piketty, and some of the famous economists who are arguing now that the disparities in wealth are absolutely making life difficult for all of us. Of course, those people who are on the right will then say, no, it will be only a matter of time before the market will self-correct. I happen to believe that the self-correction of the market is a difficult prospect. I certainly hope it happens, but self-correction of the market sometimes requires a die-off, and that's what I'm concerned about, is how much of a die-off does it take for us to correct our and utilize resources more efficiently.
So are you talking about a die-off from something like bioterrorism or an implosion?
Yeah, good question. I'm actually talking about what I call synergistic catastrophe. There is not going to be, in my opinion, and I want to point out too, I'm not arrogant about the future. I'm not saying that I'm proposing that a die-off is imminent. I'm not also proposing that there won't be a die-off, because I happen in my philosophy to believe that the predictability of human behavior is incomprehensible to the scientific community and to anyone. So we can't predict what's going to happen in the future as much as we'd like to. And getting along those lines, what I call synergistic catastrophe. And what I mean by that is that die-offs, we've never really experienced a die-off for the super civilization. Die-offs have occurred. If you read Jared Diamond's book, Painter's book back from the 80s about the collapse of civilizations, they occur all the time. What's interesting about today is we're the only civilization right now. That's it. We're so interconnected that the end result is that if there's going to be a die-off, it's probably going to be a die-off of the entire super civilization. That's the scary part. So it's not that...
What do you mean by we're interconnected? What do you mean by that? We're so interconnected.
Yeah. What I did in my book is I looked at a formula that I created called IC2ITQ, and that's rather complex, so I won't go into the details, but it's in my book. And basically, I'm arguing that our interconnectedness is 10 to the 10th greater than at any other time in 99.9% of our history as a species. If you consider existence as a species to being that of a bipedal hominin. So if you take a look at that, it's a brand new concept, our interconnectedness. We've never had it before. And what I argue, and this is the third, because you brought this up, the third aspect to the super civilization has to do with the increased interconnectedness of the super civilization that's due mainly to the Internet. So the Internet came on in the 1990s, and then in full blossom in the 21st century, and now we've got a situation where you're literally, and think about this, I want everyone at home to think about this too, you're literally closer to some people in other countries than you are to your next door neighbor. If you have a credit card or a debit card, or you're banking with a bank that has a call center in India, believe it or not, you're so interconnected now, and you don't even realize this, that you're interacting with people throughout the entire world, and you're having less interaction that is more personal. So it's more impersonal, and it's a greater interaction.
Right. I would say it's
less faceless people.
We are interconnected, but it's hardly personal.
Yes, that's right. And so the formulas that I've created, though, for this interconnectedness, the purpose that I've created for that is to point out that the development of information, the flow of information, are to such a great extent so much more rapid, so much quicker, that anything that happens can create what I call the paradox of individual power. And what I mean by the paradox of individual power is that even though you are a smaller percentage of the entire human species today, 1/7 billionth, you have never had the power that you harbor today, the potential power to change the entire civilization. And just think about this Tunisian vendor, the situation in Ferguson, you name it. You can just call it as you see it. And the bottom line is these particular instances, these small instances, can create massive resonant waves, what I call resonant waves. And these waves can then create the what I call the synergistic catastrophe. So you can have a number of factors that will harbor a difficult situation, and then you'll get the coup de grace, which is the event that, given all the smaller events that are occurring, for example, the resource decline, and then you get, for example, in your resource decline, you have less resources, you use less security to man nuclear power plants. You have more capability for terrorists to get in and steal plutonium. And the end result is you're off to the races now. And before you know it, you've got a guy showing up at the White House who the other day landed with a helicopter.
There's a drone in, yeah.
5 kilograms of plutonium right there at the White House. And that is a realistic proposition. One of the things I don't claim to be, I don't claim to be a part of U.S. security or anything of that sort. I'm just an observer looking at what I see, and what I see is not good.
It's absolutely, because, and there's so much that we're not told as well, but you can look at it as an observer and find out so much more than actually is coming through on the media. So you talked about all of these contributing factors here being a synergistic catastrophe. Why are we headed then for this mass die? I mean, what do you mean by a die-off? What percentage, what magnitude, what are you talking about?
Yeah, it can be the key thing that I can't say for sure is if we're going to have a die-off, but what is so disturbing to me, and of course, I'm dealing with trauma every day. I'm dealing with I'm dealing with the worst situation for my patients. So I tend to look at potential more than the average person. And the potential is there, and I just don't see an effort of cooperation amongst our leaders throughout the world to deal with the problems of a potential die-off. And I'm not alone, by the way. If you look at Nick Bostrom and at Oxford and Sir Martin Rees at Cambridge, they give us about a 50% coin toss chance of survival in the 21st century.
And you think this could be because of humans, not necessarily a natural disaster, right?
Oh, in fact, that's exactly what I found in doing my research on this book, is I found that what's happening is that we tend to look at natural disasters as being the cause of a die-off, when in fact it's not natural disaster. At the end of my book, it's the fault, dear Brutus, is not in the stars, it's in ourselves. And it's right there, right in front of us. And of course, I spend a great deal of time in the book talking about the different types of die-offs that can kill off our super civilization. And there's no real die-off that's purely natural that can kill off, have the potential to kill off our civilization, that is greater than, say, 1 in 100,000 chance. And I'm talking about something like a super volcano or an asteroid collision. Types of things.
Well, let's find out some more of those when we come back from the break and go through different types of situations that could threaten our civilization, so we're aware of them. We will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. My guest tonight is Dr. John Mosier. He is an emergency room doctor. He wrote a book called The Super Civilization: Survival in the Era of Human versus Human. We were just talking about how he predicts that there could be different types of die-offs of the civilization that are not caused by natural disasters, yet that are caused by humans themselves. And this could be under the category of bioterrorism or Ebola or global warming. I mean, climate change, the Keystone Pipeline. There could be so many different things that he's talking about here. So we're going to find out more about this when we come back. We're definitely going to get to solutions here too, because he does have a way for humans to be able to live in a healthier world. So we're going to find out more about that when we come back with Dr. John Mosier. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is Dr. John Mosier. We were talking before the break about different types of die-offs that could kill our civilization. So what is the difference you were explaining between the purely human-induced situations, the problems, and then the purely natural problems, Dr. Mosier?
Yes, what I did is I started out this whole journey on, and I spent about 10 years with a blank slate in my mind. I was just simply asking to myself after that bioterrorism conference, I was saying, you know, are we really capable of killing ourselves off? And then what I did is and not only killing ourselves off, but having humanity die off. And I looked at all the various factors, and then what I did is I sorted them into the etiology of the particular problem. So what I did is I created four categories. I called one category purely natural, then I called another category primarily natural, then primarily human, and then purely human. So the purely natural ones were ones such as volcanic activity, like a super volcano, not even an earthquake, but there were two or three others that showed basically they were less than a 1 in 100,000 chance, and an asteroid collision, that was the other one,
okay.
and a supernova. Those were the three that the most of the scientific community would acknowledge could end civilization. And what I did is I started with a blank slate saying, okay, what are the odds? And then I looked at and read the literature on it, and it's basically none of those were in the ballpark of more than 1 in 100,000 chance over a given 100-year period. Now, that doesn't include the type of asteroid events that can kill off, a few hundred thousand people, say an asteroid the size that occurred in 1912 in Tunguska. But it does involve the what I call a major die-off. And let me tell you what I have defined as a major die-off. Die-off of 10% chance of 10% of the population under 40 years of age who could die off over a given 100-year period.
Okay.
That's what I do. I had to come up with some objective indicator and measurement. And so in that standpoint, the purely natural die-off just was not very likely. Then the next type of die-off I looked at was a primarily natural die-off, and that included disease. And that had a more realistic chance of a die-off, and as we all know, with Ebola and HIV, malaria to a lesser extent, but basically it comes down to a communicable disease that could wipe out humanity.
So that's now primarily natural, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm calling that a primarily natural event.
Okay.
What I have found, and this is what I was looking at in studying the medical industrial, what I call the medical industrial complex, is that it's going to be very, very, very unlikely that there would be an organism that would evolve so quickly that it would kill us all off. I don't think most physicians and medical experts would say that would occur. But here's the disturbing part.
Those do exist, though. I mean, flesh-eating viruses and so forth do exist, but they're not likely to be spread Violent?
Yeah, right. Well, if you're talking about flesh eating, if you're talking MRSA, things of that sort, necrotizing fasciitis, those are individually derived bacterial infections that are primarily host-driven. The viruses are primarily what we're most concerned about, like the SARS virus, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Those are the ones that are highly communicable. But what I, in my own research, came to the conclusion was that we're not going to die from any of these diseases in major numbers. Ebola was a classic example, and it still remains a threat. But what is interesting in studying Ebola is that it's the amount of resources that we had to utilize to combat Ebola that is the more problematic aspect to dealing with disease. And that's what I spend a whole chapter on, is that it's the resource utilization to fight disease that is growing out of control. And certainly in this country, right now with our GDP running at about the per capita GDP use on medical, or I don't want to say per capita, but the percentage of our GDP that we're spending on healthcare is around 17%. It has tended to slow down a little bit in the last couple of years. However, we are still towering above any other country. And even those countries that we tower above are much greater as far as our expenditures than they were, say, 100 years ago or 50 years ago.
Now,
it's because...
No, I mean, why is that? Yeah, go ahead. You were going to say.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good question. It is that way because what we're doing is that we're getting less bang for our buck. In other words, the first diseases that we conquered, for example, if you're looking at communicable diseases and let's take the issue of antibiotics and penicillin and sulfas and et cetera, it was tinkering with those particular what I call recipes for allowing people to be cured. It wasn't a huge MRI or a CT scanner in which you're expending millions and millions of dollars to create a little bit of benefit. So what happened is in the beginning of the century, we got the low-hanging fruit. And what I mean by the low-hanging fruit is that we were able to decrease mortality significantly from some of the problems. For example, tuberculosis is a classic example,
right,
where we were able to combat it primarily, not most people think it's through drugs, but primarily through sanitation issues and the knowledge that, of course, that it was a microbe and that it could, and how it could be spread. Today, we're dealing with diseases that are not easy to resolve. And I bring it up in my book, atherosclerosis, cancer, diabetes. In fact, diabetes is the poster child for expenditures that have grown massive amounts when you consider, and by and
yes,
large,
yeah,
we do a good job combating diabetes, but the expenditures that are necessary to deal with the diabetic are astronomical.
And that's another,
that includes,
like you're talking, that's another type of die-off. That's another mini implosion.
Well, here's what I'm leading to. So what I'm leading to is this, is that we're not going to die off from a disease process. What we are going to do is utilize resources that are going to take away from other areas of society in order to combat those disease processes and just maintain, maybe get some benefit, but maintain the status quo. And we're going to continue to utilize those resources and expend those resources to gain, instead of gaining, say, 10 years on average life expectancy for every, X amount that we spend, we're going to gain 1 month. And the classic example
right.
is the fight against cancer, where we're expending, look at Gilead's drug, which is a great drug. I don't deny that it's going to be a fantastic drug for hepatitis C, but the cost is astronomical. And you can't even imagine if it's applicable to the third world unless that drug is given away to the third world where hepatitis C exists.
Right. Do you even think that we would ever find the cure for cancer in the next 100 years?
Boy, you're asking a question that I don't think anyone knows for sure. We would love to be able to say yes, but keep in mind cancer is a panoply of causes. But we've gotten quite far in our processes, especially when you take the Human Genome Project that's allowed us to now look more closely at the genetics of cancer. And looking for new ways.
But talk a lot about government and about how there's lots and lots of different control and the private interests when it comes to research and cancer cures and so forth. I mean, do you really think with all of that and privatization of medicine that we would actually have the cure for cancer?
Well, again, what I said, it's probably not going to be a cure for cancer. It's going to be, again, expenditures on a large scale. To try to find solutions for each individual cancer, because each of the cancers is so unique. So I don't want to step over my boundaries because I'm not an oncologist. I think that's a better question for an oncologist to say whether they believe that we're close to a cure for cancer. But I would say that we keep working at it. But the bottom line is the results that we're getting are expensive to deal with when we're talking about looking at the ability to increase the life expectancy of a cancer patient. That is becoming quite expensive.
That would make sense.
So what I'm arguing is, I'm not arguing that we shouldn't do those things. I'm arguing that's the conundrum of the super civilization. And that's the word, I think, is a really good word to describe it, which is a conundrum. I don't know what the answer is to that, and I'm not sure if many people do. I tried to spend 10 years to try to find that answer with the Mission Statement for Humanity, which is my goal, and I will be getting into that in a little more detail. But let me just offer this by saying that the medical industrial complex is run by a variety of interests. It's no longer the monopoly of the physician anymore. It's run by big business, big pharma. We all work together. We all try to work within a team. But I, in my book, have also argued that there seems to be a little bit less of a concern for the patient and more of a concern for profits in the medical industrial complex. So I'm not saying, I don't want to make a broad generalized statement. I just want to say, with the numbers of commercials that we see where the pharmaceutical industry bypasses the physician and they go directly to the consumer to talk to them about their product, I don't think that's a very good thing.
That's correct.
I think that's a real problem. And I think the physician-patient relationship is in turmoil right now, because I don't think physicians have as much of a say in where their patients best interests lay. And I've always said that about, I always tell my patients this, I always say that my greatest tool that I have for you isn't a stethoscope, it isn't an MRI, it's not an antibiotic, it's my ability to remain as objective as I can in the analysis of your disease process. And once I lose that objectivity, you've lost the physician. And unfortunately, there's pressure on physicians these days to relinquish that capability of maintaining objectivity.
I was going to say, you're walking a fine line by just getting off of your shift and talking like this, but you've made it, your objectivity would keep you neutral on both sides of that fence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to. It's a must, because patients otherwise will get, if we're not objective, you're just going to get people who are putting their own financial interests ahead of their interests for their patients, and I don't think that's good. And medicine is trying to combat that. I applaud the New England Journal of Medicine. They've been trying very hard to limit the amount of interfering of the physician-patient relationship, and other organizations are doing so too. We're trying, but when you've got
In this
2.8, you've got you've got a huge medical industry, trillions of dollars being spent. There are going to be individuals out there who are deeming their profits are ahead of everything else.
How do you avoid that as a doctor of the pushing drugs and getting profits from it or perks and so forth of the job? How do you deal with that?
Well, it's not easy in this day and age.
Right.
I do, whenever I walk into the hospital, believe it or not, whenever I walk into the hospital, I always say to myself, I have to be at the top of my game. I have to make sure that I am always looking out for the best interest for my patient. And that is along every aspect. Unfortunately, when I'm in the hospital and I have resources that I rely on to help me, including the hospitals themselves, which, mm-hmm. again, everyone in the medical industrial complex, there may be a few that aren't this way, but everyone in the medical industrial complex, by and large, is trying their best to help patients. But there are some out there who naturally want to put profit ahead of everything else. So what I try to do is, the main thing is I try to divorce myself in any way, shape, or form from anything other than the most objective finding that I can find based upon what I read in journals and what is best for my patient. And that's not easy.
Yes, and my father was an MD for 38 years, so I know the world. I know the world, but it has definitely changed since he's retired. And that's one of the reasons. It's running a business sometimes more than it is being a doctor when you have a group that you're involved with. So there's definitely a fine line there. All right.
And of course, also the amount of money that's spent on marketing. Like, for example, sleep aids, I pointed out, and I believe, and I forget which one because I don't want to don't for sure, but the sleep aid, Vanity Fair did an article a few years back that found that the amount of money that was spent on advertising for sleep aids was greater than the entire budget of the NIH on sleep studies. If that isn't a marker of what the medical industrial complex is about, that is, there is no other than that.
It's not done in other countries. It's just us and New Zealand that have the direct-to-consumer marketing, right?
Yes. Again, you probably studied that closer than I do, so I have to be careful. I don't want to make any statements that I'm not sure, but that sounds...
a couple of sources, but I've heard that. All right, so I wanted to ask you about the climate situation. So could the same theories apply to our climate control with more money being spent on resources and trying to solve that problem than has actually gone into solving the problem?
Ms. Garr, I can see you've read my book because that's exactly where I went with this. Is what I did is I took my knowledge of the medical industrial complex and then I started to apply it to climate change and what's going on in climate change. And the bottom line is that we're not going to, for climate change, it's not an issue of one day you're going to wake up and it's going to be 100 degrees warmer and everyone's going to be in a tizzy. What's happening is the same thing that's happening, and if I may, I'd take antibiotic use as a classic example, where we started out using antibiotics that are cheap, and then then resistance builds, and we find another one, then resistance builds to that, then we find another one. And if you look at the cost of each antibiotic that we use to create a new antibiotic, and keep in mind the ability to use an antibiotic and effectively has more than the component of simply does it cure the illness. It also has a component of side effects. So what happens is we...
Dr. Morger, I'm sorry, we have to take a quick break, and I want to get back into this because this is a huge topic, and I want to spend time on it. So if you don't mind, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about the antibiotic use. Be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM.